managed to get jobs teaching in the GED program, the gig I had previously longed for but didn't interest me any longer. I felt guilty about preferring CMS work, but I had been observing the unpleasant developments in the education department and was keeping my distance. Following the mold shutdown of the GED program in the winter, all the tainted books and curriculum materials had been thrown out and were not replaced. The prison had transferred a popular female staff member out of the camp and down the hill. I guess she was too sympathetic to prisoners. In her place, the new head of education in the camp was a mullet-wearing, Trans-Am-driving vulgarian. I called him Stumpy, who rumor held had basically flunked out of the postal service, only to be picked up by the BOP. He was an inadequate excuse for a teacher, who resorted to and clearly enjoyed threatening and verbally abusing his pupils. He was universally loathed by all campers, and most of all by the inmate tutors who worked for him. According to them, his attitude toward his pupils was simple. "I don't care if they never learn that 1 + 1 = 2. I get paid for 8 hours of work." One day, I returned from the electric shop to find the camp in an uproar. Stumpy had been on a serious tear that day in the classroom, more abusive than usual, and Alice the pacifist had finally had it. She wanted to be released from her job as a tutor. Stumpy went ballistic, screaming and ranting and writing her up with a shot for defiance, or resisting a direct order or something along those lines. Pensatucky, who had been in the classroom, and was probably the object of his initial abuse, said that his dumbass face had turned purple. He had gone storming out of the camp and down the hill. But now rumor had it that he was trying to have Alice locked up in the SHU, and everyone was outraged. Sure enough, after dinner and mail call, we heard the thud of heavy boots and the rattle of chains. Massive men, their boots making the most stereotypically ominous stormtrooper noise, entered the camp carrying restraints. They stomped by the phones, down the stairs, and down the hallway toward the camp CO's office. Every prisoner picked up on those sounds, no matter where they were in the building, and the front hall quickly and quietly filled with women, gathering to see it go down. Sometimes, when someone was getting locked up for doing something shitty, or when the miscreant was widely disliked, there was an air of the tumbrils on the way to the guillotine. This was not one of those times. The PA crackled as Mr. Scott called the condemned. "Gerard!" Little Alice Gerard came up to the office and stepped inside. The door closed, and she was in there with those three huge men, as the lieutenant read her the shot that had been filed against her. A buzz was building among the women. "This is bullshit. This ain't no thing for the SHU. That little lady didn't do a damn thing that didn't need to be done." Someone started to cry. "I can't believe these pansy-ass cracker cops got nothing better to do with their time than lock up Alice." The door to the office swung open. Alice stepped out, followed by the three jailers. They loomed over her, making her look extra tiny as she gazed up at the assembled crowd. Blinking through her Coke bottle glasses, she said brightly and clearly, "I'm going." One of the lieutenant's goons cuffed her, not that gently, and the buzz among the women surged to a low roar. Then Sheena started to chant, "Alice, Alice, 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 Alice," as they led the little pacifist away. I had never seen prison guards look scared before. One hot afternoon found me under a tree, trying to stay out of the sun. Along came Mrs. Jones, with Inky, her constant companion. I had finished her final paper, a pretty straightforward essay I had pieced together about the role that hybrid cars might play in the future economy. I had tried to pull some big ideas from Managing in the Next Society into my argument about knowledge-based economies, globalization, and the ways in which demographics change society. But it was upsetting to think about what role the millions of Americans who were former prisoners might play in the next society. I knew from the Families Against Mandatory Minimums, FAMM, newsletters which many prisoners received, that over 600,000 returned home from prison every year. The only markets most of them were accustomed to participating in were underground economies, and nothing about the prison system that I had seen showed them any other route to take when they hit the streets again. I could count on two hands the number of women in Danbury who had participated in a real vocational program. Pop, who had earned a food service certificate down at the FCI, Linda Vega, who worked as the camp's dental hygienist, and the handful of women who worked in Unicorps. For the rest, maybe their work scrubbing prison floors or in the plumbing shop might translate toward a real job, but I was skeptical. There was no continuity at all between the prison economy, including prison jobs, and the mainstream economy. "Hey, Mrs. Jones, did you get the paper back yet? I was just coming to talk to you about it. I'm mad as hell." I sat up, worried. Had she been busted? Maybe a disgruntled classmate had ratted her out? That wouldn't shock me. "What's wrong?" "We got an A-." I laughed, which only made her more irritated. "What was the problem?" she wailed. "It was a great paper. I read it, just like I said I would." She was very indignant. "Maybe he didn't want you getting too cocky, Mrs. J. I think an A-minus is just great." I don't know what they're thinking. Well, anyway, I wanted to say thank you. You're a nice girl." And with that, she jerked Inky's leash and marched off. A couple months later, she was marching again. All of the women who had completed the GED or college classes were honored in a ceremony held in the visiting room. Miss Natalie, Pensatucky, Camilla, and of course Mrs. Jones would be wearing mortar boards, along with a number of other women. Each graduate was allowed to invite a set number of guests from either the outside or the inside, and I would be attending as a guest of the OG. The valedictorian was Bobby, who had scored the highest on the GED exam. Over the weeks leading up to the ceremony, she agonized over her address, writing and rewriting it. The day dawned scorching hot, and the room was set up with two banks of chairs facing each other, graduates versus guests. The women filed in solemnly, looking sharp in their caps and gowns, black for the GED students, bright blue for the collegians. There was a podium where Bobby would give her speech. But first, we would have to hear from Warden DeBoo. This would be her swan song. She was getting a brand new prison in California to supervise, and we were getting a new warden, a guy from Florida. Bobby gave a great speech. She had picked a theme, "We Did It," and was off and running, congratulating her fellow students for getting it done, reminding all assembled that achieving a diploma was not easy in this setting, but they had done it, and proclaiming that now that everyone knew they could do it, there was nothing else they couldn't do if they stuck with it. And they each had a diploma to prove it to the world. I was impressed by the care Bobby had put into her words, and by how well she delivered them, with just the right edge of defiance. The speech was brief, lean, and mean, but firmly asserted that it was the graduates' day to celebrate, not the institution's. She spoke forcefully, naturally, and with pride. Afterward, the prisoners were allowed to have pictures taken. Against a fake cherry tree backdrop in a corner of the visiting room, I stood with my friends, each of whom I was proud to know. Bobby, posing with a group of us clustered around her in our khakis, looking stern and short in her robes and special gold-corded valedictorian's robe, but her hair was blown out and beautifully curled. In one snapshot, Pensatucky and another M&M-lit grin as widely as any high school senior in America on their last day. I look so old next to them, smiling in my khaki uniform. My favorite is the photo of me and Mrs. Jones. I stand happily behind her, and she is seated, radiant in her royal blue robe and cap, holding her diploma in front of her with pride. On the back of the picture, in her terrible handwriting, it says, "Thank you. To a dear friend, I made it, God bless you, Mrs. Jones. Chapter 11. Ralph Cramden and the Marlboro Man. I hit a groove, and the days and weeks seemed to go faster. I passed milestones, one quarter of my sentence, one third of my sentence, and prison seemed more manageable. The outdoors showed me the natural passage of time in a way that was new to a lifelong city girl. I went from trudging through ice, then mud, then grass, mowed by the ladies in grounds. Trees budded, and wildflowers and even peonies bloomed. Baby bunnies appeared at the side of the track and grew into saucy teenage rabbits right before my eyes as I ran around and around that quarter-mile loop thousands of times. Wild turkeys and deer freely roamed the federal reservation that the prison sat on. I developed a deep distaste for Canada geese, who shat dark green goose poop all over my track. One sunny afternoon, I was loitering on the bench in front of the electric shop in the sun, listlessly trying to read a slim volume of Candide that some wiseacre had sent me. Mr. DeSimon had not shown up to work, a mercifully common experience. That morning, it had been difficult to read because of the thundering gunfire. Very close by the CMS shops, hidden about a quarter mile away in the woods, was the prison's rifle range. Correctional officers could spend quality time with their firearms down there, and the hammering of multiple rounds was typical background noise during our work days. There was something unsettling about toiling away for a prison while listening to your jailers practice shooting you. When we got back from lunch, the gunshots had ceased, and it was once again a placid rural Connecticut day. One of the institution's white pickup trucks pulled up next to me in front of the carpentry shop.
"What the hell are you doing, convict?"
It was Mr. Thomas, the boss of the shop. The carpentry and construction shops were housed in one building, to the left of the electric shop and on the other side of a shambling greenhouse. The electric shop did not have a bathroom, and we had to walk over to use the one in their building. The bathroom was for single use only. A spacious private room on whose walls someone had painted pretty blue designs. I loved that bathroom. Sometimes when my co-workers in electric were squabbling or watching illicit trash television when DeSimon wasn't around, I would flee to the bathroom for a few blessed minutes of privacy and quiet. It was the only door in the prison that I could lock. The construction and carpentry shops were led by Mr. King and Mr. Thomas, respectively. Mr. Thomas was round and volcanic and inclined to noise, jokes, and occasional blue streak outbursts, like a present-day Jackie Gleason. Mr. King was lean and lanky, taciturn and weathered, always with a cigarette dangling from his mouth. He looked like the Marlboro Man. They had been sharing this shop for many years and had a close working relationship. When I would walk into the shop to use the facilities, Mr. Thomas would usually note my presence with a shout,
"Hey, criminal!"
Now he wanted to know what the hell I was doing. My fellow B-dormer, Alicia Robbins, was in the seat of the truck next to him. Alicia was Jamaican and tight with Miss Natalie. She was giggling, so I doubted that I was in trouble. Nothing?
Nothing? Well, do you want to work?
Sure.
Well, get in.
I jumped up and climbed into the truck. Alicia scooted over to make room for me. I didn't think I could get in trouble if I was with a CO. Mr. Thomas pressed the gas and the truck took off. We veered past the plumbing and ground shops, headed behind the FCI, and then abruptly plunged down a steep gravel road. I had no idea where it led. Almost immediately, the buildings disappeared, and all I could see through the pickup's open windows was forest, trees and boulders and the occasional creek, all sloping sharply downward. The truck's radio was blasting classic rock. I looked at Alicia, who was still giggling. "Where is he taking us?" I asked her. Mr. Thomas snorted.
"Boss crazy,"
was all Alicia would say. The road plunged down, down, down. We had been driving for many minutes. It didn't feel like I was in prison anymore. I felt like a girl in a truck heading toward an adventure. Resting my bare forearm on the truck door, I fixed my gaze deep into the woods, so that when the trees flew by, all I saw was a blur of green and brown. After several minutes, the truck broke into a sort of clearing, and I saw signs of people. In front of us was a picnic area, and some of the women who worked in construction and carpentry were painting wooden picnic tables. But they didn't interest me at all, because what I saw beyond them filled me with so much excitement. The picnic area lay on the edge of an enormous lake, and the June sunlight was glinting off the water that lapped gently at the edge of a boat launch. I gasped. My eyes widened, and I could not have cared less about maintaining my cool. Mr. Thomas parked the truck, and I jumped out. It's a lake. I can't believe how beautiful it is. Alicia laughed at me, grabbed her painting gear out of the back of the truck, and ambled over to a picnic table. I turned to Mr. Thomas, who was also looking at the lake. Can I go look at it? Please? He laughed at me, too.
Sure, just don't jump in. Get me fired.
I rushed down to the edge, where there were floating docks, and a number of small motorboats that belonged to prison staff were moored. I was trying to look everywhere at once. On the far bank, I could see houses, beautiful houses with lawns that sloped down to the water. The lake appeared to be very long, disappearing out of sight on both my right and my left. I crouched down and stuck both my hands into the cool water. I looked at my two white hands through the brownish cast of lake water, palms down, and imagined myself submerged, holding my breath in with my eyes open underwater and kicking as hard as I could to swim fast. I could almost feel the water swirling in currents around my body and my hair rising like a halo around my head. I edged along 10 yards of the lake shore in one direction and back again, thinking that this would be the first summer of my life without swimming. I had always been a total water baby, never scared of the surf. Now I itched to rip off my clothes and throw myself in. But that wouldn't be prudent or fair to the guy nice enough to have brought me down here. The sunlight off the water made me crinkle my eyes. I looked for a long time, and no one said anything to me. Finally, I turned and climbed back up the concrete embankment. I went over to Gisela, who drove the bus and worked for Mr. King, and asked if there were any extra paintbrushes. She smiled. Sure, let me show you. And I spent the rest of the afternoon silently painting under the trees, listening to boats on the lake and the sounds of water birds. When it was time to go, Mr. Thomas drove us back up to the shops. I got out and stood on the passenger side with my hands on the window frame and looked into the truck at him. It was really nice of you to bring me down there. Thank you so much, Mr. Thomas. It meant so much to me. He looked away. He seemed embarrassed.
Yeah, well, I know that boss of yours won't bring you down there, so thanks for helping out.
He drove away. From that moment forward, I was obsessed with getting back to the lake. Arriving at work one day, we were startled to discover that DeSimon had shaved off his beard and mustache and now looked a lot like a lost penis, wandering around in search of a body. My interactions with him had grown unpleasant, as I resented the fact that I worked for the nastiest man in construction services, and he seemed to take perverse pleasure in treating me in as degrading a manner as he could devise. At lunch, I was complaining bitterly about him when Gisela stopped me. Why don't you come work in construction? I'm going home in September. Mr. King will need somebody good. He's so nice, Piper. It hadn't occurred to me that I could change jobs. A couple days later, I sidled up to Mr. King in front of the shop, shy but desperate. I wasn't used to asking COs for anything. Mr. King, I know that Gisela is leaving soon, and I was wondering if maybe I could come work for you in construction. I waited, hopefully. I knew I was a desirable prison employee, I had my prison license, was willing to work, never idled, faked being sick, was educated and could read manuals, do math, and so forth. And I didn't have a big mouth. Mr. King looked at me, chewing on his cigarette, flinty eyes unreadable.
Sure.
My heart leaped, then crashed.
But DeSimon has to sign your cop-out.
I wrote up the cop-out, a simple one-page form, the official title of which was BPS-148-055 Inmate Request to Staff. The next morning, I marched into DeSimon's office and handed it to him. He did not take it from me. After a while, I got tired of thrusting it toward him and put it on the desk. He looked at it with distaste.
What is that, Kermit?
It's a cop-out, asking you to let me go work in construction, Mr. DeSimon. He didn't even read it.
The answer is no, Kermit.
I looked at him, his bulbous, shiny pink head, and smiled grimly. I wasn't surprised. I marched back out of the office.
What did he say?
Asked Amy. We were down to me, my young Eminette-lit pal, Yvette, and a couple other women working in the dim, airless electric shop.
What do you think? I said.
Amy just laughed, with a hollow wisdom way beyond her years.
Piper, that man is not going to let you go anywhere, so you might as well get used to him.
I was furious. Now that I knew there was a better way to live within the confines of the prison, that there were jobs where prisoners were not the constant object of insults, I was desperate to make the switch. Getting out of electric and escaping from DeSimon filled my thoughts. Summer was getting hot, and for months we had been working on a new circuit for the visiting room air conditioners. The only rooms in the camp that had air conditioners were the staff offices and the visiting room, but the existing power was insufficient, and they always tripped off. So we had hung and wired a new circuit panel, bent and run conduit around the visiting room, and wired new outlets. Now we were close to finished, and all that remained was to connect the circuit board to the building's main power source, a floor below in the boiler room. This involved pulling new cables up from the boiler room power source to the new panel in the visiting room, physically yanking them up through the guts of the building. When the momentous day dawned, we all gathered the tools that DeSimon had directed us to bring and stood in the boiler room waiting for direction. We didn't have any big girls in the electric shop, and so reinforcements had been called in from plumbing, which had a bunch of them. DeSimon busied himself with the cables. They were big, thick industrial cables, totally different from the wiring that I now worked with every day. He bundled several of them, then bound them together with black electrical tape, taping over and over until they were bound together for over a foot. At the end, he strung a rope, the end of which was snaked up to the visiting room. The women from plumbing were all up there waiting. Down in the boiler room stood me, Amy, Yvette, and Vasquez. We looked at DeSimon.
They're gonna pull, and you're gonna push. You're gonna feed it upward. But we're missing one thing. We need a greaser.
The way he said those words, I knew that it must be an unpleasant job. And I knew who it would be.
Kermit, you'll be the greaser. Take these.
He handed me elbow-length rubber gloves.
Now, grab that tub of lube.
He pointed at a vat of industrial lubricant next to his feet. I could see where this was going. My cheeks were beginning to burn.
You're going to need a lot, Kermit.
I grabbed the container. DeSimon shoved the bound cables toward me. They were rigid and inflexible, and I was rigid with humiliation.
That's gonna need a lot to squeeze in there, Kermit. Lube it up good.
I bent and scooped up two handfuls of the stuff. It was like bright blue jelly. I slapped it onto the huge, previously innocuous but now disgusting foot-long phallus. DeSimon threw his head back and yelled, "Pull!" The rope yanked, but not enough to move the cables.
Come on, Kermit. Do your duty.
I was so angry I could barely see. I concentrated on turning the blood in my veins into ice. I tried floating up to the ceiling in detachment,
but the scene was so ugly that my usual technique didn't work. I scooped up more blue jelly and slapped it all over the bound cables.
Oh, horse cock. You like that horse cock, don't you, Kermit?
Horse cock? I dropped my hands to my sides in their big, gooey gloves. Amy was looking at her shoes, and Yvette was pretending she didn't understand any English. DeSimon yelled, "Pull!" again, and somewhere above us, prison laborers heaved on the rope. The cables slid.
"Pull!"
They slid again.
"Push!"
My co-workers pushed the cables upward. Seeing them strain, I bent my knees and helped them push up as hard as I could. The cables started to slither upward, and then it was all over but the pulling. I stalked out of the boiler room, stripped off the gloves, and threw them down. I was blind, nuclear mad, and all I could do was throw the ladders, the tools, and the gear into the back of the truck as hard as I could. My co-workers were unnerved. I didn't speak to anyone for the rest of the afternoon, and DeSimon didn't speak to me. Back in the camp, I tried to shower the slime and humiliation off me. Then I wrote another cop-out, this time to DeSimon's boss. It read something like this. As I have discussed with you on previous occasions, Mr. DeSimon, my work supervisor, sometimes speaks to us at work in ways that I find crude, disrespectful, and sexually graphic. On 3/23/04, while working in the boiler room on the new electric circuit for the visiting room, we were working with large electric wires bound together with electrical tape. Mr. DeSimon referred to these materials, which I had to grease to pull through pipes, as horse genitalia, which I found very offensive. He did not use the word genitalia, but rather a vulgarity. That was all the room there was to explain a request on a cop-out. I was not going to spend the next 7 months under the thumb of this pig, I vowed, and I hoped that in the form of horse cock, he had handed me the trump card for my escape. At my next opportunity, I went to the office of DeSimon's boss. He was a horse of a different color, making a career of the BOP and moving from prison to prison, climbing the corporate ladder. He was from Texas, where they certainly know something about prisons, and a complete professional. Very tall, he always wore a tie and often cowboy boots, and was unfailingly polite. He was also even-handed, which won him the admiration of the prisoners. Pop called him my Texas Ranger, and liked it when he would come up to the camp to eat our cooking. I knocked on his door, walked in, and handed him my cop-out. He read through it silently, then looked up at me.
"Miss Kerman, I'm not sure I understand what you're trying to say here. Will you please have a seat?"
I sat and took off my white baseball cap. I could feel my cheeks getting hot again. I chose a spot on his desk to stare at so I wouldn't have to make eye contact with him, so he couldn't see my shame and I wouldn't start crying in front of a police. Then I explained what my cop-out meant, in great detail. When I finally finished, I took a deep breath. Then I raised my eyes and looked at Tex. He was as red as I was.
"I'll switch you out of there immediately," he said.
July dawned with a sour flavor. The entire camp facility seemed to groan in the heat, overtaxed. The phones stopped working. The washing machines broke, a horror show. Suddenly all the hair dryers disappeared. 200 women, no phones, no washing machines, no hair dryers. It was like Lord of the Flies on estrogen. I sure as hell wasn't going to be piggy. To escape the camp's simmering tensions, I liked to sit under the row of pine trees overlooking the track and the valley beyond, especially at sunset. Now that I knew what the lake looked like, I would imagine diving in, deep under the water and swimming away. I would strain my ears to catch the sound of the motorboats far below. It was such a pretty spot here. Why did they have to ruin it with a prison? I missed Larry terribly on those evenings, wishing that I were with him. I checked the call-out every day to see if my work assignment had changed. After a week, I learned that my attempt to escape the electric shop had been thwarted because Rotten DeSimon had gone on vacation unannounced, and Tex wouldn't transfer me out to construction until he returned. I couldn't understand this at all. But when I pressed him, sounding as desperate as I was, the big Texan put his hands up as if to say, "Stop. You're going to have to trust me and be patient, Miss Kerman. I'll get you out of there." Miraculously, my transfer from electric to construction finally happened, popping up on the call-out at the end of July. Tex had been as good as his word. I did a little victory dance in the camp's main hall. My new co-workers included my buddy, Allie B., the cheerful 6-foot oddball from B dorm, and Pensatucky, who was in contention for white girl with the biggest mouth. The carpentry shop was largely made up of Spanish mommies, including Maria Carbon, the almost catatonic girl I had greeted in room 6 back in February. She had regained her equilibrium in the intervening months, and the difference between that terrified girl and this slightly macho, bravado-filled convict was striking. Everyone was welcoming to me, and there was no evidence of the downtrodden misery I was used to in electric. The construction and carpentry shops were housed together and smelled of wood and paint and sawdust. I now worked for Mr. King, the chain-smoking Marlboro man. I had a new neighbor in B dorm, who I nicknamed Pom Pom based on her hairdo. Pom Pom was a bashful 22-year-old who spent a lot of time sleeping and quickly got a rep for laziness. She probably slept so much because she was depressed, a normal enough response to prison. She had been assigned to work in the garage, where she pumped gas into the prison vehicles enthusiastically. She didn't seem lazy to me. If you looked at her and smiled, she would cast her eyes away but smile her own shy smile. One day in the dinner line, Pom Pom abruptly turned to me and began to talk. I barely knew her and assumed she must be speaking to someone else, her co-worker Angel, perhaps, who was standing on my other side. No, she was speaking to me, and with some intensity. "Boss called me into his office today and he was asking me if I've had any relatives here before." Mr. Senecal was her boss in the garage. "So he was asking me, and it turns out my mother worked for him." I looked at Pom Pom. At present, we had 3 sets of sisters locked up in the camp, and another neighbor's mother had apparently been shipped out right before I arrived. At this point in my own prison stay, it was less surprising to me that she was a second-generation federal inmate than that she did not know her mom had worked in the garage. "You didn't know she worked in the garage?" I asked. "No, I knew she was here, my aunt told me, but she never told me nothing about it." I had a terrible suspicion that Pom Pom's mother might be dead. Angel, her co-worker, was of course listening in and gently asked the question, "Where's your mom?" "I have no idea," replied Pom Pom. I felt even worse, but I was still curious. How did Senecal know? "He just guessed. He thought it was my sister, but he just guessed." "Do you look like your mom?" he guessed from looking at you. "I guess so. He asked me, tall and skinny, right?" Pom Pom laughed. "He said he just had a feeling, so he asked me. And then he asked me what I was doing here." I wondered if the prison staff connected the miseries of their chosen profession with the miseries of their prisoners' children. Did it trouble Mike Senecal to find Pom Pom in Danbury? And was he waiting for her children to show up? Maybe if her mother had been put in treatment for her addictions, which were implicit, rather than in the garage in Danbury, Pom Pom wouldn't be standing in his office today. "What did Senecal say about your mom?" "He said she never gave him any trouble." I didn't much care for Pom Pom's boss, but I liked to hang out in the garage. I stopped in every morning to get the white construction pickup and shoot the breeze with the gals who worked there pumping gas and fixing trucks. There was a debate going on about what was the song of the summer. Angel said it was the big crossover reggaeton hit with Daddy Yankee. I didn't know the name was Oye Mi Canto, but we could all sing the refrain.
Boricua, moreno, dominicano, colombiano, boricua, morena, cubano, mexicano, oye mi canto.
Bonnie snorted. Y'all are crazy, she said. It's Fat Joe. We all replied, leaned back, and dropped one shoulder back in smooth unison.
Kenyatta said, Well, I don't like her, but that song by Christina Milian, Pop, Pop, Pop That Thang, that song is blowing up.
This made me giggle. In yoga class the other day, Yoga Janet had been trying to get us to loosen up our hips. Okay, everyone, wiggle your hips, shake them out. Now rotate them, circle left, now right. Okay, now I want you to pop your hips forward, your pelvis in a smooth motion. I want you to pop that thing.
Sister Platy had been bemused. Pop that thing?
Camilla and I had died.
Pom Pom spoke up.
I don't know where you think y'all are at, but there's just one song this summer, and that's locked up. Look around you. End of discussion.
We had to admit, she was dead on. All summer long, anywhere there was a radio playing, you could hear the almost eerie, plaintive voice of Akon, a Senegalese rapper, singing about prison. Can't wait to get out and move forward with my life. Got a family that loves me and wants me to do right. But instead, I'm here locked up. Even if the song had not been a huge hit on the outs, it had to be the guiding anthem in a place like the camp. You heard women who weren't even hip-hop fans humming it tunelessly under their breath as they folded laundry. I'm locked up. They won't let me out. No, they won't let me out. I'm locked up. Chapter 12. Naked. I was a big fan of my coworker, Allie B. She made me laugh all the time. She seemed lighthearted. That is, when she wasn't pissed off about something. Her pendulum swung a little wildly. She didn't have the heavy hallmarks of incarceration on her, even though this was not her first time down. In fact, she was a violator, which made sense because she was a junkie. But she wasn't locked up for a drug crime, so she wasn't getting any kind of treatment for her addictions. I would ask her, Come on, you're clean, and you've been clean for the whole time you've been locked up, so why go back to it? She would just cock her head and smile.
You obviously have no idea what you're talking about, Piper, she said. I cannot wait to get a taste. That and some dick.
This we knew. As much as Allie loved to get high, she also loved sex. She would run filthy and hilarious commentary under her breath about any man she saw who struck her fancy, prison guard, staffer in a tie, or the occasional unsuspecting delivery guy who wandered into our field of vision. Allie would sometimes refer to me as her wife, to which I would respond, Fat fucking chance, Allie. She occasionally experienced bursts of, I think, mock lust, during which she would chase me around B-dorm screaming filthy things and try to yank down my gray running shorts while I screeched. Our neighbors quickly grew irritated by our roughhousing. From her speech and her writing, and despite her passion for fear factor, I could tell that Allie was better educated than most prisoners. Without asking my pal the personal questions, verboten even between friends, I had to guess that her multiple stints in prison were due to her addiction. I worried about Allie. I certainly hoped that she would never see the inside of a prison again. But more than that, I was concerned that she could end up dead. I had similar concerns for Allie's sidekick, Pensatucky, who had been a crack addict, I could tell from her blackened front teeth. Unlike Allie, Pensatucky didn't want to get high as soon as she hit the streets. She wanted to get her daughter back. The child, an angelic-looking toddler, lived with her father. Pensatucky had no parental rights. She was not right, according to women around the camp, which was something said about people who struggled with behavioral problems, or sometimes outright mental illness. The conditions of the prison did not make these challenges easier. Now that I had known Pensatucky for a while and worked with her, I thought she had more on the ball than people gave her credit for. She was perceptive and sensitive, but had great difficulty expressing herself in a way that was not off-putting to others. And she got loud and angry when she felt disrespected, which was often. There was nothing wrong with Pennsylvania that would have prevented her from living a perfectly happy life, but her problems made her vulnerable to drugs and to the men who had them on offer. If your drug problem lands you on the wrong side of the law, you might end up detoxing on the floor of a county jail. Once you get to your long-term prison home, the first thing they'll want to do is assess your psychiatric state and prescribe you some drugs. The twice-daily pill line in Danbury was always long, sneaking out of the medical office into the hall. Some women were helped enormously by the medication they took, but some of them seemed zombified, doped to the gills. Those women scared me. What would happen when they hit the streets and no longer could go to pill line? When I walked through the terrifying gates of the FCI 7 months before, I certainly didn't look like a gangster, but I had a gangster mentality. Gangsters only care about themselves and theirs. My overwhelming regret over my actions was because of the trauma I had caused my loved ones and the consequences I was facing. Even when my clothes were taken away and replaced by prison khakis, I would have scoffed at the idea that the war on drugs was anything but a joke. I would have argued that the government's drug laws were at best proven ineffectual every day, and at worst were misguidedly focused on supply rather than demand, randomly conceived and unevenly and unfairly enforced based on race and class, and thus intellectually and morally bankrupt. And all those things were true. But now, when I looked in dismay at Allie, who was champing at the bit to get back to her oblivion, when I thought about whether Pennsylvania would be able to keep it together and prove herself the good mom that she aspired to be, when I worried about my many friends at Danbury whose health was crushed by hepatitis and HIV, and when I saw in the visiting room how addiction had torn apart the bonds between mothers and their children, I finally understood the true consequences of my own actions. I had helped these terrible things happen. What finally made me recognize the indifferent cruelty of my own past wasn't the constraints put on me by the U.S. government, nor the debt I had amassed for legal fees, nor the fact that I could not be with the man I loved. It was sitting and talking and working with and knowing the people who suffered because of what people like me had done. None of these women rebuked me. Most of them had been intimately involved in the drug business themselves. Yet for the first time, I really understood how my choices made me complicit in their suffering. I was the accomplice to their addiction. A lengthy term of community service working with addicts on the outside world would probably have driven the same truth home and been a hell of a lot more productive for the community. But our current criminal justice system has no provision for restorative justice, in which an offender confronts the damage they have done and tries to make it right to the people they have harmed. I was lucky to get there on my own, with the help of the women I met. Instead, our system of corrections is about arm's-length revenge and retribution, all day and all night. Then its overseers wonder why people leave prison more broken than when they went in. Vanessa Robinson was a male-to-female transsexual who had started her bid down the hill in the FCI. Within the confines of the Danbury plantation, her presence was notorious. The COs insisted on calling her Richard, her birth name. One day, the camp was abuzz. The he-she is coming up! There was great anticipation of Miss Robinson's arrival. Some women swore that they would not speak to her. Others professed fascination. The West Indian women and some of the Spanish mommies expressed disgust. The born-agains made outraged noises, and the middle-class white women looked bemused or nervous. The old-timers were blasé. Ah, we used to have a bunch of girls that were trying to go the other way. They were protesters, said Mrs. Jones. The other way? I asked. Go from a girl to a boy. Always bitching about their medication and bullshit, she said, with a dismissive wave of her hand. I soon got my first glimpse of Vanessa. All 6 feet 4 inches of blonde, coffee-colored, balloon-breasted, almost all-woman that she was. An admiring crowd of young women had gathered around her, and she lapped up the attention. This was no unassuming shim, unfortunately incarcerated and trying to get along. Vanessa was a full-blown diva. It was as if someone had shot Mariah Carey through a matter disruptor and plunked her down in our midst. Diva though she was, Vanessa had the intelligence and maturity to handle her new situation with some discretion. She began her time in the camp almost demurely, with no histrionics. Several other women had come up from the FCI with her, including a startlingly beautiful young woman named Wainwright, who was her bosom buddy. They both sang in the church choir. Wainwright was petite, with green cat eyes, an enigmatic smile, and a college education. Most of the other black women worshipped her on sight. They were a visually hilarious pair, similar looking in theory, and yet so dramatically different. For their first several weeks in the camp, they hung together most of the time. Vanessa was friendly if approached, but more reserved than her reputation and appearance would suggest. She went to work in the kitchen. "He can't cook," scoffed Pop, who fell into the disgusted category and was disinclined to be kind, although there was some truth in her culinary assessment. There was a ketchup in the marinara sauce episode that had the whole camp up in arms. Pop hissed into my ear who the culprit was, but I kept it to myself. I liked Vanessa, which was a good thing because she moved in next door to me. She and Wainwright managed to finesse the housing assignments they wanted. Wainwright bunked with Lionel from the warehouse, who was the voice of reason / discipline when it came to unruly young black women. "Girl, you better get some act right, or I'm gonna bust your head to the white meat." And Vanessa moved in next door to me with Faith, a steel-haired, oxy-dealing granny who was straight out of the New Hampshire woods and had come up from the FCI with Vanessa and Wainwright. They got along great. Vanessa's arrival in B-dorm evoked some eye-rolling from Miss Natalie, but she was more tolerant than her friend Ginger Solomon, who demanded, "Is that what you want to see in the bathroom, Miss Piper?" "Well, is it?" I meekly pointed out that Vanessa was post-op, but no, I wasn't necessarily looking for a free show. Free shows were available. As Vanessa settled in, she got more boisterous, and she was thrilled to display her surgical glory at the merest suggestion. Soon half the camp had seen what she'd got. Her D-cup breasts were her pride and joy, and given our height difference, they were often the first things I saw in the morning. She was certainly better looking than many of the prisoners who had been born to our gender, but close quarters revealed some of her more masculine qualities. Her pits were positively bushy. She said that if she couldn't wax them, then fuck it. And in the hot, close quarters of B-dorm in the summer, she smelled unmistakably like a sweaty man. Vanessa was deprived of her hormones in prison and thus retained several male characteristics that would have been less evident otherwise, most notably her voice. While she spoke in a high little girl voice most of the time, she could switch at will to a booming, masculine Richard voice. She loved to sneak up behind people and scare the crap out of them this way, and she was very effective at quieting a noisy dining hall, roaring, "Y'all shut up!" Best of all were her Richardian encouragements on the softball field, where she was a most sought-after teammate. That bitch could hit. Vanessa was an entertaining and considerate neighbor, cheerful and drag queen funny, smart and observant, and sensitive to what others were thinking and feeling. She was quick to pull out her scrapbook and share photos and stories of the men whose hearts she had broken, cutting up to make the time pass. "This is the program from the Miss Gay Black America pageant. I was third runner-up." All the born female aspiring divas, most of whom lived in B-dorm, immediately recognized that here was a master at whose feet they could learn. And Vanessa was a good influence on the young girls who flocked around her. She admonished them gently when they were behaving badly, and exhorted them to educate themselves, get with God, and love themselves. She had just one ritual that was hard to take. Every evening, when she was finished with work in the kitchen, Vanessa would return to her cube, climb up in her bed, and bring out a contraband tape player, obtained somehow through the chapel. Her absolute favorite gospel song, detailing the fact that Jesus was loving, forgiving, and helping us to take every step, would soar over the cube walls, and Vanessa's voice would soar with it. This was when the need for her hormones really became most apparent. Vanessa simply could not hit the high notes. The first couple of nights she did this, I smiled to myself, entertained. By the 10th, I was burying my head under the pillow. However, considering some of the other songbirds we had in close quarters, I decided to grit my teeth and bear it. One hymn a night wouldn't kill me. One of the many contraband items I had in my possession was nail polish. There had been a time when it was sold on commissary, but now it was a banned item. Yoga Janet had given me a bottle of gorgeous, bright magenta polish, which my pedicurist, Rose Silva, openly coveted. I promised that I would give it to her when I went home, but for now I kept it for myself and for Yoga Janet, who also loved beautiful toes. Any self-respecting New York woman has a good pedicure, even if she's in the clink. I had been Rose's customer for a while now. That there were prison pedicurists was one of the few true things I had gleaned in my pre-prison research, along with the strong recommendation that if you were going to avail yourself of their services, you had better buy your own tools from the commissary. The prison population has a high incidence of blood-borne diseases like HIV and hepatitis, and you don't want to risk an infection of any kind. When I first got to the camp, I was far too shy to request a pedicure, though I admired Annette's gold toenails. "I only go to Rose," she explained. There was actually only one other option to Rose, and that was Carlotta Alvarado. Pop was among Carlotta's clients. Between the two of them, they split the market. Prison petties are strictly a word-of-mouth business, and in this case, prisoners were fiercely loyal. I had my first petty back in the chilly early spring. Annette had given it to me as a gift. "I got you a pedicure with Rose Silva. I can't stand looking at your toes in those flip-flops anymore." A week later, I dutifully reported to one of the room's bathrooms off the main hall to rendezvous with Rose, armed with my own pedicure tools, cuticle clippers, orange sticks, foot file. All these were sold by the commissary, but no colors of nail polish. Rose arrived with her own toolkit, including towels, a square plastic basin, and an array of polishes, some in decidedly odd colors. I felt very awkward, but Rose had the gift of gab and was businesslike. Rose and I quickly established that we were both from New York, she from Brooklyn and me from Manhattan, and that she was Italian-Puerto Rican, born again, and serving 30 months after getting caught trying to bring two keys of coke through the Miami airport. She had a no-nonsense briskness and liked to clown. She also gave a meticulous pedicure and a damn good foot massage. No one is supposed to touch you in prison, so the intimacy of a languorous foot rub, intended to please, almost sent me into ecstatic tears the first time. "Whoa, honey, take some deep breaths," she advised. For all this, Rose charged $5 of commissary goods. She would let me know on shopping day what to buy her. I was hooked. I was a customer. Rose's latest effort on my feet was definitely her masterpiece so far. It was a pale pink French pedicure with magenta and white cherry blossoms added on my big toes. I couldn't stop looking at my toes and my flip-flops. They were so cotton candy fabulous. Despite the groove that I had settled into, I still had flashes of irritation with my fellow prisoners, which troubled me. In the gym, I nearly lost my temper with Yoga Janet during class when she insisted that, yes, I could get my foot behind my head if I just tried a little harder. "No, I can't," I snapped. My foot is not going behind my head, period.
Being among many people who very pointedly couldn't or wouldn't exercise much self-control was taxing, and I meditated a great deal on more self-control. Sitting there in prison, I heard a lot of horror stories. Of women with many children they loved but couldn't handle. Of families with both parents locked away for long years. And I thought about the millions of children who are put through terrible experiences because of their parents' poor choices. Coupled with the government's crap response to the drug trade, which perpetuated the damaging myth that they could control the supply of drugs when demand was so strong, it seemed an enormous amount of totally unproductive misery, which could only come back to hurt us all later. I thought about my own parents, about Larry, about what I was putting them through right now. This was the penitence that sometimes happens in the penitentiary. It was emotionally overwhelming, and when I saw women still making bad choices day to day in the camp, or simply acting objectionably, it upset me. I was pretty staunch in maintaining an us and them attitude about the prison staff. Some of them seemed to like me, and I thought they treated me better than they did some other inmates, which I considered rotten. But when I saw other prisoners behaving in ways that challenged my sense of unity, for lack of a better term, behaving in petty or ignorant or just plain antisocial ways, I really had a hard time with it. It drove me a little nuts. I took all this as a sign that I was too engrossed in prison life, that the real world was fading too much into the background, and I probably needed to read the paper more religiously and write more letters. Focusing on the positive was hard, but I knew I had found the right women at Danbury to help me do it. A little voice in my head reminded me that I might never see anything quite like this again, and that immersing myself in my current situation, experiencing it, and learning everything there was to know might be the way to live life, now and always.
"You're thinking too hard," said Pop, who had managed to do over a decade on the inside and still stay sane.
Boy, was that a nice pedicure. Plus, there were light bulbs to change, term papers to ghostwrite, sugar packets and hardware to steal, puppies to play with and gossip to gather and pass along. When I thought too much about my prison life, when I should have been thinking about Larry, I felt a little guilty. Still, certain things brought my absence from the outside world into sharp relief, like once-in-a-lifetime events that would happen without me. In July, our old friend Mike would be wed in the meadow on his 51-acre spread in Montana. I wanted to be there, among friends in the gorgeous Montana summer, toasting Mike and his bride with tequila. The world kept going despite the fact that I had been removed to an alternate universe. I wanted to be home desperately, and when I said home, that meant wherever Larry is, more than Lower Manhattan. But the next 7 months stretched out in front of me. I now knew I could do them, but it was still way too early to count the days. On July 20th, Martha Stewart was sentenced to 5 months in prison and 5 months of home confinement. A pretty typical split sentence for white-collar criminals, but far below the maximum for her conviction. Some prisoners raised eyebrows over her sentence. About 90% of criminal defendants plead guilty. Usually, a defendant who does take a case all the way to court and loses a federal trial is hit hard by the judge with the maximum sentence, not the minimum. This had happened to a number of women in the camp who were doing very long bids. Regardless, most of the camp was convinced that Stewart would be someone's new bunkie in Danbury, and that would certainly liven things up. If Martha were designated to Danbury, I felt pretty sure they'd stick her in the A-dorm suburbs with the OCD cases. I had been hearing about Children's Day since I got to Danbury. Once a year, the BOP held an event when kids could come to the prison and spend the day with their mothers. Activities were planned, including relays, face painting, piñatas, and a cookout, and the children got to walk around the campgrounds with their moms, very vaguely like a regular family enjoying a day at the park.
All the other prisoners were confined to their housing areas. For this reason, gals in the know had strongly suggested that I volunteer to help out, if only so that I would not be stuck in my cube for 8 hours on a potentially hot day. They needed a lot of hands, so in that first week of August, I was summoned to a volunteer meeting. I would be manning the face painting booth. When Saturday arrived, it was, in fact, hot as hell, but the camp was humming with nervous energy. Pop and her crew were toiling to get the hot dogs and hamburgers ready. Volunteers were either milling around or getting our stations ready. There was a little pop-up canopy over the face painting table, scattered with pots and pencils of rainbow-colored grease paint. I was surprised at how nervous I was. What if the kids were badly behaved and I couldn't handle them? I certainly wasn't about to reprimand another prisoner's kid. Just imagine how that would go over. I anxiously questioned the other face painter, who was an old hand. "It's easy. Just show them the designs and ask them what they want," she said, totally bored. There was a sheet with line drawings of rainbows